Okay, it's rolling, so I can't forget that. Didn't forget that. That's a good thing. Let's get this bad boy fired up. Do attendance. And give you back your homework from the other day. At least those of you who did it. I have an answer. It's due on the day it's due. Understand this rule of obligation. All right. We did that, we did that. All right, we're going to continue forward with our bystander's rule of obligation. But speaking of homework, your next one's due on Wednesday. So the next three assignment number two. It's just like this one. Anthony is, pass that back to Anthony. Pass that back. There you go. Carlton. All right, so how it worked is that Matt, is that if you get a check, that means you just did the bare minimum. If you got a check plus, that meant you went above and beyond. And what do I mean by above and beyond? That means that you had in there references to specific rules of law. You know, you compared the facts to the rules of law. And again, you don't get graded on what you came up with as the outcome. That's not what I was concerned about. I was looking for the analysis. So if you go above and beyond, that's a check plus. If you do the bare minimum, that's a check. And if you do not do, Jose, if you do not do all three cases, then you get a check minus of varying degree. So if you do one case, that means three will get added in. Pass that back to Lex. If you did this B, if you did two, that means you got 7 out of 10. Hey, Carol. You know, actually yours is here, because I'm out of B. Hold on, we can't get Michael's. No man exception, Michael. Friday, when you came in. Oh, bless you. Oh, yeah, you got me nothing, so no exception for you either. All right. Aiden is right here. All right. Juliana. He's right there. I'm like, looking right at you. I was. That was bad. And then no joke. All right, good.
All right, keep in mind the collective average of all 10 homework assignments, that's 20% of your final grade. So if you miss one, it's not the end of the world. But don't start missing them regularly, because your grade will be impacted significantly. Oh, and by the way, I'm sensing there will be a quiz soon. So I'll put you on watch of that as well. Key. No Nico in the back. Austin is here. Cole. Carlton. What? That meant you... All right, so... You got 10 assignments, each are worth a base of 10 points. So that meant you got 10 of 10.
Or with a check plus.
Check plus, you get a 13. And if you get a check minus, you get a 7. If you did 2 of 3, you got a 3 if you did 1 of 3. All right. Oh, crap. Aiden is here. Michael is here. Juliana, Ethan, Lex, Anthony, Matthew, Amber, Lucas, Reed, Jose, no Dylan, Adamir, and Andrew with all his friends in the first row. All right, so refresh my memory. Because again, I had a long weekend. I was in Indianapolis. I was working on behalf of veterans all weekend long. So my brain isn't quite as sharp as it should be. It's kind of foggy. I don't really remember what the bystander's rule of obligation is. What is it? Now you are 100% right, but you've got to blast your voice across the room.
One has no duty to assist someone in peril unless
they're treated. All right, as a general rule, if you didn't create the harm or the peril, you don't have to lift the finger. You do not have to get involved. You do not have to put yourself in danger. You don't have to get intermingled. That's a very harsh rule if you think about it. Because that literally means you could sit back and watch someone die. I know. And the typical everyday Lamanic would be like, hey, it wasn't me. Why am I going to risk anything? But over the years, because again, this is something that came out of common law, which if you recall from the beginning, that meant English judges hundreds of years ago came up with these rules. Well, in the modern times, judges became a little more, or actually maybe not judges, I should say courts, became a little more sympathetic to the human condition. And they started realizing there may be certain circumstances when even if one didn't create the harm, maybe we should kind of compel them to do something to prevent further harm. Case in point. Major exception number one. Commonly referred to as the employer's exception. The employer's exception. And this exception, like most exceptions, were created out of a situation that occurred in real life. The case came out of Iowa in 1921. Here are the facts. Weird shit happens every day. All right. So, Guy, apply the bystander's rule of obligation to this fact pattern. Apply the rule you read to me. All right. So, Davis is the boss. Did Davis hurt Carrie? No. Who hurt Carrie? The son. I don't care how much of an asshole your boss is, your boss cannot control the son. So he's out there and he gets hurt. So under the bystander's rule of obligation, is Davis liable? No. Damn. Right? Damn. He didn't create the harm. But he didn't do anything to mitigate the harm. And why did he not do anything to mitigate the harm? He didn't create it. Is this a good policy? Would you want your boss to be in a similar situation? Comes upon you, you're passed out on the ground, flops you up in a wagon, and just leaves you there so he can go and finish his work? Well, the Iowa court originally ruled for Davis. They applied the bystander's rule of obligation. But Carrie's family, by the way, he was mentally disabled for the rest of his life as a result of these injuries. And there was no such thing as workman's compensation or any type of Social Security or anything like that. So Carrie's family appealed, it gets up to the Iowa Appeals Court, and the Iowa's Appeals Court said, you know something? There's something different here about a normal bystander situation. What is it?
Davis did intervene on some of us in regular reading scenarios, so he was no longer a bystander, but I guess I'm going to go to a touching and carry, put it into the wagon, did not know the else was in there.
By doing that, he rendered it impossible for anyone else to intervene.
Yeah, that's a part of it.
Any other thoughts?
Employment.
Employment, what do you mean?
Your boss asked you to do a job in compensation for something you paid. So because your boss asked you to be out in the hot sun, they might have had a compensation to look after your safety.
You know what they didn't also realize back then? Dehydration.
They didn't know about that.
Any other thoughts? Well, the court basically just said this isn't right. This is wrong, regardless of what the common law says. So what did they do? They carved out an exception to the rule. The exception is this. And by the way, all of these elements must be in place in order to claim this exception. First, it can't be any other normal, typical bystander. This exception only applies if the guy who didn't create the harm is the boss. And notice, it's not or, it's and. While on the job, something happens to the worker. He is suddenly stricken. And by the way, foreseeability plays no role in this. Whether what could happen was foreseeable or not, not relevant. Just the worker is out on the job and boom, he falls over. And it just can't be because the worker's lazy. No. There must be a legitimate, significant emergency where aid must be rendered with haste. And lastly, the linchpin of them all. Granted, you got to get the first three elements plus the fourth. The employer has to see it. The employer must see it. The employer must be present. Want me to change things up? Here you go. You were working, you worked your whole shift, and you get into your car to leave. And then you have a heart attack in your car, in the parking lot. Boss comes by 3 hours later and sees you in your car. Does the employer exception to the bystander's rule of obligation apply? Anyone say yes? Okay, why? Apply the rule. No. When did he have the heart attack? When? Before the employer arrived. How many hours? Three. He didn't see him. Oh, we're all done.
Let's say he did see him.
If he's off the clock and he sees them, then yes, because technically he would still be on the employer's grounds. But no, notice what I did. I just slipped that little fact in there. Saw the car, see him in the car 3 hours later. It's done. You're done. The courts must apply the established rules to the facts. And if the facts don't satisfy each step in the rule, you're done. It's over. Just like what happened during the trial. At least the trial judge perceived it that way in Clinton v. Jones. The judge gave summary judgment to Clinton because he or she, I don't remember if it was a guy or a gal, felt that Jones could not actually establish sexual harassment. So he finished it and issued summary judgment. But of course, granted, in that situation, it was a close call and it should have gone to the jury. Because it really came down to he said, she said. But in my fact pattern that I changed this up, that 3-hour time delay, that's enough because it wasn't in the moment. He was stricken, not in the moment, 3 hours prior. So the boss does not have to get involved. Because chances are, by the time he shows up, 3 hours later, you're already dead. Questions? All right. So we know the bystander's rule of obligation. And the employer's exception is the first exception that you're going to need to know. You're going to have to remember how it works. Because just like I did in my hypothetical, that's what I'll throw at you on a quiz or an exam. Here's an easy exception. Parents. I know, it should be two. That's what I was looking at. There is a two, I just don't know where it's going to come up. As much as it pains me, if I see something happen to one of my kids, I have to do something about it. Darn it. And by the way, parents have a heightened duty. So going back to this, the duty here is to aid. Employer has a duty to aid. With a parent, well, there's spouses as well. Actually, I'll put them both because they're both the same. Not only do you to your spouse have a duty to aid, you also have a duty to warn. So you have two duties to your spouse and your kids. Duty to warn from known dangers. Duty to aid if there's an emergency. So I'm going to pull an old example out. Back when you had me last time, I had done some work in my yard, and I dug a big trench because we put in an above-ground pool, and we had to run electricity out to where the pool was. So there was a big trench out there. Under the exception for spouses, I had to tell my wife every time she went outside, "Be careful, honey. There's a big hole. And if she fall down, go boom." I had to go help her out. Same with the kids. Same with the kids. Every time. I have a duty to warn and a duty to aid. What? You think just because it's a Thursday, my wife falls in the hole? Sorry, honey. It's Thursday. I don't have to warn you or help you today.
You already made it clear to
me. As long as the harm persists. Reasonability. Reasonability. Although, truth be told, is there was the big trench where the walkway was, but within 2 days, that part was filled back in. But neither here nor there. Yeah, kids don't. Did you listen to your parents every single day? I'm sure your mom and dad told you stuff, and you missed 99% of it. You'd probably go in it. Yeah, you'd fall in it. You'd play in it. Yeah, you'd just have enjoyed plenty of fun in the trench. But in all seriousness, this is present any time the person nears the danger. What happens if it's not a spouse or a child? What happens if it's a stranger? Well, actually, it depends.
What if, I kind of have a question a little back. What if, like, does your parents still have the duty to aid if they're, like 80 and they're, like, 40?
If the parents can help, yes. But, of course, if the parents are unphysical able to help, how much effort does it take to dial 911? Call someone to help. Because aid doesn't mean you physically have to get your head dirty. Aid just means you have to push things in motion. Think of it like domino rally. You know, you have to push the first domino down. That's going to result in them getting up. Other questions? Good question. Thinking out of the box. I like that. Oh, in loco parentis. That's the Oh. This also applies to guardians, by the way. If you are not with mom and dad, maybe you were raised by grandma and grandpa, or maybe you were raised by uncle or aunt, anyone who has guardianship over you, this also applies. Anyone acting on behalf of the parent. In loco, in lieu of parents. Same thing applies to teachers, babysitters, anyone who is given the right to have temporary oversight over the children. So that's why this will be a standing rule from now until the end of the semester. I want you all to take note when you leave. There's a line in the doorway. You, under no circumstances, are allowed to die in this room. Get your ass out in the hallway and die out there.
Thank you.
You know, the funny thing is I can guarantee you there's one person in this class that's like, oh my God, that's awful. All right. What about said stranger? Do people who own land in general have any type of duty to an individual who enters the land of another? Don't say no, Amber. Like everything, the answer is it depends. It depends upon the nature of who that is entering the land. Because let's be honest. Right, there are three types of people that enter onto the land of another. And as Carol said, the first and most obvious is what happens to someone who does not have permission to be on the land. You cannot shoot them. Now here is what happens. Generally, if you trespass, which means you're entering the land of another without permission, the owner does not have a duty to warn you of any dangers on the land, nor do they have a duty to render aid. So if you go hiking and you trespass into someone's land and they own 1,000 acres and you fall down and break your leg, you're trespassing. The owner has no duty to come and help you. So when the inevitable bear or coyote comes and starts taking bites out of you, you can't sue the landowner. Because the defense of the landowner is that person did not have permission to enter the land.
Wait, so if it wasn't a trespass, you say...
No, don't get ahead of me. Only dealing with trespassers. Because I've already said there are three types of people who enter the land of others. Let me get to the other ones because I guarantee I'm going to cover it. All right. Anything else with trespassers?
If the border to the land isn't clearly marked.
Doesn't matter. It's not the duty of the landowner to tell a trespasser when they are on their land. It's the duty of the trespasser to realize that all land is owned by somebody, and unless you have consent, You do not have a right to enter the land of another.
If the trespasser believes that they were invited and it was an escape, that is a bucket.
Give me a situation where that will happen.
Contractor working on somebody's house, person wants to show up to visit, there's confusion over whether or not they're supposed to show up, they show up.
If someone was showing up to visit, that's one of the other types. Anything else? Trust me, I got it all covered. I got it all covered. Or I don't, the law does. Alright, so I will go to bloodthirsty Andrew's point over here. You don't have a duty to warn, you don't have a duty to render aid, but you cannot lay traps. If you know someone is trespassing, you cannot lay traps.
Is that state dependent?
No. It's true everywhere.
Is that, like, people just, some people have traps for, like,
if it was laid by the landowner to trap a beaver and a human steps on it, not present. They're a trespasser.
Okay. But like you're saying, as if someone moves to look on their land,
exactly. Now, I will say this. There is also in the law something known as the castle doctrine. So if you trespass onto the land of someone else and you attempt to break and enter into their dwelling, then the homeowner has a legal right to defend him or herself, their family, and their property. So I hate to tell it to you, if you are allergic to lead getting in your belly, do not break and enter into my house. Because you will hear two sounds. Chunk chunk and boom.
Don't you have to, like, really claim, like, your life is in danger in Massachusetts?
Massachusetts.
You have to, like, do, like,
yeah, isn't it?
No,
like,
no,
can't.
No. In Massachusetts, well, no, that's not true. In Massachusetts, it depends. Massachusetts operates under the premise that you are required to retreat to the wall. In other words, you're backed into a corner, you have no other means. That's it.
But, how could you go to court, how can you say your life was in danger?
The person was coming at me.
But do they have to have, like, a firearm?
If it depends on the situation. If it's during the daytime and all the lights are on in the house, yeah, you probably have to actually see one. Mm-hmm. But if it's the bump in the night, the better solution would be for that 5% of our population that refuse to follow the laws of decency and common good should just grow up and follow the rules. But what do I know? All right, there is one exception to the trespassers. No obligation, no duty to warn, no duty to aid. And that's if it's a child that is the trespasser and they're drawn onto the land by what's known as an attractive nuisance. There's something that child would see that a reasonable child of like age would be drawn to.
So, like, say their neighborhood had a playground.
A playground, a swimming pool, a pile of sand. Something that could lure the kid on the land. Then, in that situation, you have both a duty to warn and a duty to aid. Which, by the way, that's the reason why in Massachusetts there is bylaws that are in place in all 351 communities in the Commonwealth. That if you have an in-ground pool, you must have a permanent fence around the pool. And if it's an above-ground pool, the ladder must be removable at all times. Yes. So how does that work? Well, if you have an above ground pool and you leave the ladder attached and a kid climbs in it and drowns, you're going to be liable for that. Now, if the ladder is not attached and the kid somehow makes an effort to get up in the pool and falls in, that's a different situation. But if you provide an easy means for the child to get access to the water, you will be held 100% liable. Wrongful death. You won't be charged for like murder, you won't be criminal, but you could be sued civil. What they'll do is they'll make a determination on the nature of your way to open it. What? Yeah. So that's the reason why the gates typically that are installed and fences around the pool, you know, you kind of have to like reach over if you go visit, and it's something only an adult could do.
What if they climb it?
Yeah.
Well, again, would a reasonable child of that child's age be able to do it? Would they be deterred? Well, here's the thing. Under state law, I think it has to be a 3-foot fence, maybe a 4-foot fence. If the fence is in place and the child goes over it, then the landowner can use that as a defense. They followed the law. They installed the type of fence that was required. By the way, there is going to be one of the cases in the homework. I think it's this nature. The same similar situation happened where there was an accident and the person sued, but the defense ultimately was is you don't have to break your bank to prevent all types of possible harm. You only have to do the minimum what is established by law. So long as you do that, that's your defense. All right. Other questions on children? Attractive nuisance. All right. The next type of person who enters the land is known as a licensee. A licensee is somebody who is allowed to enter the land based upon the owner's consent. Whether it's an express consent or an implied consent. An express consent or an implied consent. So, going back to Orion's hypothetical, if I invited you to come over, and even if I have a contractor working on my land, you are a licensee. Because I invited you.
That was an actual court case.
Right. Well, based on the express invitation, the landowner would have to warn the licensee, hey, I got a contractor working. Careful. Doesn't mean they have to go on and shield them. They don't have to throw their body in front of the bulldozer. Just have to say, hey, you know, I got some guys working on my house. Just be mindful of that. That's enough. There has to be just a duty to warn. But, once warned, the burden falls on the licensee to prevent themselves from being harmed. So, what does this mean? Well, if I invite Anthony over my house and I tell him, hey, look, I got some guys working. I'm not exactly sure what they're doing, but there may be someone there. Well, when he shows up at my house, that means he has to, like, look around and see, oh, are the contractor's van here? Are there any tools laying anywhere? You know, I don't have to go out and pick them up on my shoulders and carry them in like a little swaddle baby. I don't have that obligation. Questions? So, duty to warn, but no. So with a licensee, duty to warn, no, duty to protect. As far as duty to aid, if I invite him over my house and something happens to him, yeah, I gotta help out. I can't leave him out in the yard to die. Questions? Now, by the way, do not get licensee confused with invitee, because they are different. Have any of you ever gone to a concert? How do you get in the building? With a ticket. And what does that ticket grant you the right to do? What? Go in and watch the concert. Anything else? Anything? Well, you can wash and tee dead if that's allowed by the facility. Well, what happens if the facility says, no washing? Can you wash? What happens if you decide to? You're out. You're out. Well, concert, the plug is pulled. I actually was at a bar back in the day, and I was seeing a band, and the band played heavy metal music, and a pit erupted, even though the bar staff was like, no. They turned the lights on, they shut off the stage, and they kicked everybody out of the bar. They shut it down for a night. All right, so why do I mention that? Well, very simple. Very simple. If you are a licensee, it's like you have a ticket. That's your license to enter. And you have to adhere to the terms of the license. So if Anthony comes over to my house, he can come on in. He's welcome to sit in my living room. You know, he can have some of the food if I prepare food. I'll even let him use a bathroom. But you know where he cannot go? Into my closet. That's beyond the terms of the license. Unless I say to him, hey, Anthony, you know, I got an extra pair of shoes in my closet. Do you want to go get those for me? Then that license has been expanded. But ultimately, it's the landowner that controls the nature of the license. All right. Invitees. Well, invitees are basically not required to get an advance invitation. Invitees are allowed to enter the land for the purpose that the land is held open. You come over my house and you randomly show up, I do not have to let you in the house. If I call you and say, come over, there's the difference. But what happens if you go to a park? The park ranger didn't call you and say, come on down. There is a public space of land that is open to the public. Well, if you go to that park, you are under the status of a public invitee. What can you do? Well, you can use whatever facilities are at the park. So if they have a nice playground, you can play on the playground. If they got a basketball court, you can play basketball. If they have a public swimming pool, you can go swimming. But you know what you can't do? Driving dirt bikes around. Unless, of course, they have a designated dirt bike track. So basically, there are spaces that are open to the public for the public's use. But you only can do what is provided for you. So if you go to, say, a state park, they can actually say, no motor vehicles allowed. You would also get in trouble if you decided to bring a chainsaw and started randomly cutting down some trees. You're not allowed to harvest lumber in a public State Park, etc. Walk the trails, fine. Go canoeing, fine. But that's it. Whatever you're allowed to do, whatever the land is held open to the public to do. What happens if you enter as a public invitee? Well, there is a duty to warn of known dangers. So one of the parks that I've gone to the most in my life is Purgatory Chasm. Just because I was raised in Whitensville and now I live in Sutton. And all over, as you get close to the chasm, there are signs. Careful, rocks are slippery when wet. There's the duty to warn. And if you do slip and fall, and it's during the time when the rangers are there, which is just the summer season, then someone on staff has a duty to aid. But you know what they don't have? They don't have to sit there and hold you and wrap you in bubble wrap. They don't have a duty to protect you. Duty to warn you. Duty to render aid. No obligation to protect. Questions? So, by the way, if you do go to a park and there is a reasonably foreseeable danger and the park rangers were aware of it and they didn't put up some type of warning sign, they breached their duty and that would make them liable.
Is it grizzly bear a reasonable danger that they should put up a sign for, or is that like...
It depends. Depends. Exactly. If there hasn't been a grizzly bear sighting in 50 years, and then just because of in the town next door, they decided to put in, you know, a subdivision of McMansions, and they cut all the woods down, and the bear one season just migrates out, and they didn't know it was there, then no. But if there were sightings, there were efforts to kind of like mitigate the harm, and they didn't warn the public, then yes, they could be like,
I've been leasing one of the McMansions, and the property owner that I was leasing it from knows that I was close to it, and it would tell me I'm close to it.
Do they? Well, if they're in a known flood zone, then by law they have to have flood insurance. So if you die, their insurance policy will cover it. Ha ha ha! Other questions? Alright, well, what happens if you decide you want to go to Walmart? Well, if you go into a state-owned, town-owned, public land, you're a public invitee. If you go to a business, you're a private invitee. Private invitee enters the land for the purpose that it's directly or indirectly connected to the owner's business. So, if you go into Walmart, what are you there to do?
Shop.
Exactly. So, as you shop, duty to warn, duty to protect, or sometimes called the duty of care. So, you're shopping, and the Walmart guy or gal finds out that a jar of tomato sauce fell off the shelf and went, what must they do in a reasonable period of time? Clean it, but what should they do first? Sign out, put that little slippery floor sign out. Because by putting that slippery floor sign out, that sets the clock back even more. So they have a reasonable amount of time. And what's reasonable? Well, it depends on the jury. Reasonable amount of time to react to the known danger. And then a reasonable amount of time to take care of the danger. So, you go to Walmart at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. Again, there's no actual answer. What do you think would be a reasonable amount of time for the store to react to that situation? A minute to 5 minutes? Because obviously a customer will probably be the person who sees it. The first customer will probably be lazy and just kind of walk around it, not say anything. But eventually a customer will say something to somebody. That's when the clock starts ticking. What would be a reasonable amount of time to get the sign out? What would be a reasonable time after that point to clean it up? Well, how many people are working that day? Is there anyone in the department? Are there janitorial staffs there? All that would play a factor in determining reasonability. During the day, they probably have the most staff on. There's probably the most customers. They'll probably be notified the quickest. I would say they would probably have to be there 15 minutes, tops, to be on it, and probably another 15 minutes to clean up. But what happens if it's 3 o'clock in the morning? And the only ones on are a couple of cashiers in front. What would be the reasonable amount of time in that situation for you? Well, it might be longer. It might be an hour. You know, because there's less customers. So that means there's less chances or opportunities for someone to notice it. There's less staff on, so they'll have less of ability to go and see it or discover it or take care of it. It depends. It depends on the circumstances. But there is no absolute hard, you have 17 minutes and 37 seconds to respond. Just depends. On reasonability. Questions?
So stores don't have the duty to aid?
They would only have the duty to aid if they fail to protect you.
I work at the grocery store down there, and one time I left my department, and this guy, I guess he passed out. I don't know who called the ambulance, but we wouldn't have had to call the ambulance.
No. No. Did you create the harm?
No.
Yeah, you just leave it and die. Although then eventually all of his bodily fluids would excrete from him and it would just be kind of messy. But that's the bystander rule of obligations, ladies and gentlemen. That's what the rule said. If the guy had a heart attack in the store, it wasn't the store who created the harm. But let's be honest. In that situation, human beings, what is someone going to do? Oh my God, you gotta help him! They'll freak out, and then there'll be some type of intervention.
So, private victims have the duty to warn protectors?
Yes. Yes. Reasonable duty of care. Duty to warn, duty to protect. And render aid if someone's harmed from a breach. If this occurs. Oh, yeah, do it private? Yeah. Do it there. Again, they can't leave the tomato sauce there without a sign. They have to take reasonable effort,
so is it duty to protect from foreseen reasonable dangers? Yes. Reasonable.
So you're walking down the aisle, and suddenly there's an 8.5 earthquake, and the whole shelf falls over and squishes you. You can't turn around and say, oh, me getting squished was foreseeable. You're a breach of duty to protect, so I can win. What?
Yeah,
that's not
foreseeable. What about if it was like, can you see it earthquake coming?
I think.
So then, what about it?
Yeah, but the problem is that I don't think it's
not like super accurate. Though.
Yeah, you don't get like warnings 8 months. And hold on. Businesses only have to have, in that hypothetical situation, shelves based on whatever regulations are established by that state.
If this school was easily operated, that doesn't mean earthquakes, they have to shut down the operation.
Right. Well.
Yeah, they have to redesign all.
Right. Yeah. This building, because of its age,
it would be grandfathered, plus the fact that we do not live in an area where there's an active fault zone. So this would not have to be built to the same standards as, say, construction in California, Southern California.
Things you got to remember. There's no absolute, hard, fast. It depends. Depends upon the circumstances. Questions? We're going to skip this one, because this one is established in your homework. Tarasov case. What about if you want to get involved? What if you want to be like that guy that saw the fight break out and rushed into the Circle Inn, begging with the bar staff, please let me call 911. What if you want to be a good Samaritan? Well, I'll be honest with you. It depends upon the state. This is a situation where every single state in the union has established different Good Samaritan statutes. And it really depends on which state you're in. Because if you have good intentions and you violate the statute, you will be held liable. I have three examples, and then we'll do Massachusetts. Example number one, if you are a Good Samaritan in the sovereign state of Alabama, the Good Samaritan statute will only protect you from being found liable if you are a trained medical professional. If you are a trained medical professional. Alabama.
So like if you're a nurse and you're
if you're a doctor, you're a nurse, and you see something and you intervene, and the person as a result of you trying to render aid is harmed further, you will be held liable unless you are a doctor or a nurse or an EMT. Because they'll determine whether or not the action is based on like best medical practices.
Okay, so if you aren't a doctor, that's what we're held liable.
If you are not a doctor, then you will be held liable. You have no Good Samaritan defense.
So that's like you render aid and make possible.
Right. So you see someone choking in a restaurant, you go to give them a Heimlich, and you break their rib. If you're a doctor, well, let's be honest, doctor, they're trained. They know, and there's also the expectation that even if they do it properly, it could result in some kind of internal damage. But if you're not a doctor, yeah, you'll be liable. You'll have to pay for that broken rib. Oklahoma, it's the exact opposite. Statutory protection is only for non-trained medical personnel. So if you are a licensed doctor and you break their rib, you're liable for that. But if you're just a common person, you didn't know any better.
Oklahoma.
In Vermont, all persons, whether you medically train or not, are required by law to intervene. You are required by law to get involved. Vermont. If you do not, you do one of these with the big guy behind me, then you will be held liable, possibly, for all injuries that occurred, whether or not you caused the harm or not. Vermont has, under their statutes, completely negated the bystander's rule of obligation. So, it's always important to know the law in the states that you're in, right? Because can you turn around and say, well, I'm not from here. I didn't know what the law was. No. Ignorance, under no circumstance, is a defense. What about in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts? Well, we have a statute, and it's actually known as the Massachusetts Good Samaritan Law. Under this law, it protects ordinary citizens who are acting out of kindness. So you see something, and you are just a good person, and you are just trying to help. Then you will be shielded from liability. So, this law applies to all non-medical professionals. It does not shield medical professionals. They are held by the standards of their license. But in Massachusetts, if you are a non-medical person and you are acting in good faith during an emergency, you will be shielded. So, what does the law mean by good faith? Anyone want to take a stab at it? All right, so I fall over, it looks like I'm having a heart attack. You happen to notice on the wall that there's a defibrillator. You've never been trained on the device. But you don't want me to die, so you pull the device off the wall, do all you can to put the probes and probs in the right place, and then you hit the button. And then I die. Can my estate sue you? No. Carol's not. Are you a nurse? Do you have any type of certifications, anything like that? She's just a normal person. She knows that that device is there to help out in the event of a heart attack. She just did the best she could. No, my estate could not sue her. She was acting in good faith. Oh! Yeah, that's the whole purpose. Because if you're an idiot and you screw it up, you still were trying to do something. You were trying to help. Okay, response time. I fall on the ground right now. How long do you think it's going to take for one of the Worcester firefighters to get here? Versus, you know, there's a defibrillator somewhere on this floor, and you run down, get it, and put it on my chest. Response time. All right. Here's the second thing. You will get shielded if, one, you act in good faith. Two, not for compensation. Not for compensation. As I fall down, I can't say to Andrew, Andrew, I'll give you $100 if you save my life. If he says, okay, and then he kills me, guess what? We're taking him for everything that he has. But what happens if he's not paid, and he's acting in good faith? But he decides, because he saw it on a Looney Tunes cartoon, the best way to get my heart beating is to stomp me on my chest! And then I die. Will the Good Samaritan law in Massachusetts shield him? No. Why? Why? Again, well, think about it. He sees me fall over. He's not getting paid. He wants to help, and he decides.
Bumping is not going to help.
Exactly. Is that not a wanton, negligent act? Is there anybody in this classroom would think that you could revive somebody by stomping on their chest as hard as you can? This cruel, evil, sadistic bastard will be sued, sued, and sued again. Take everything. Except for those that pair of socks that you still have in your drawer that has the holes in it. We don't want that. Oh, by the way, do you want to know another way to become liable if you try to help? And this will not shield you under the good Samaritan law? I fall over, and I see it's him coming, and I say, don't you fucking touch me. If the person expressly states they do not want aid, and you give aid, you will be responsible for everything that happens to that person. Questions? So I'm going to go over it again, because I could easily ask you on the exam, give you a situation, and say, would the Massachusetts Good Samaritan law apply in this situation? What I will be looking for is, are you saying the person's acting in good faith? Is the person acting not for compensation? And are they acting reasonably? Yes, 100%.
So if aid is rejected, you don't want aid, what protection as like a license?
Sorry,
I mean, they don't want you to help them, you're protected by the
state. You don't have to, you're not obligated to help. If I had a do not resuscitate and I was resuscitated, yes, I would have a claim. Other questions?
Say like someone calls you in and you didn't want you in because the insurance didn't cover it. What happened?
Did you expressly tell the person not to call? If you told them not to call, then yes. But if you were unconscious, too bad. When we deal with contracts, where we're going to see a situation where someone was brought into the hospital unconscious and tried suing, claiming they were not responsible to pay the bill. Because they didn't give consent. Their argument was the opposite. Not that consent was negated and denied, you know, don't help me, but rather, well, I didn't ask for it to begin with. Well, that person lost the case and had to pay the bill. That's contract law. We'll talk about that. There's another question?
What about when it comes to a do not resuscitate?
That's what was asked. If you have do not resuscitate and you are resuscitated, yes, you could have a claim. Usually you have healthcare proxy. You have documents on file. If you know, that's part of like estate planning. You get your will, you get healthcare proxy, power of attorney, things like that. And if you have a do not necessitate document, it has to be signed and notarized for it to be effective. Other questions? Oh. I didn't realize it was there. There you go. If you already got it, you already got it. If you don't got it and you want it, now is the time to get it. Because I think if I click again, it's going to go to another page. I could be wrong, though. All right, hold on. Good. Good. All right. This is also something that's important. So let's say, like this, this is the actual language that comes out of the statute. If presented before a court, how should a court interpret the statute? Because keep in mind, when the legislature makes statutes, they're generally not expressed in plain English. Well, they're also very broad, they're very general. And if you have a situation that comes before the court, it's very specific. So how would a court actually apply a statute in a situation? Well, generally, the general rule for the courts is they are required to apply the plain meaning of the statute. So this means there's not an expectation that you are a lawyer and that's been practicing law for 20 years. No. Rather, the court's supposed to interpret it just like you were to pick it up, as just a layperson. What do these words mean in general English? That's how it should be applied. Sometimes it's referred to as the literal rule. So what does this mean? Well, this means you're not trying to read into it. You're not trying to broadly interpret it. No. If it says the store shall be open at 9 a.m. on Monday, that's how you should apply it, because that's what it means. Now notice, you shouldn't be sitting, well, it didn't necessarily say which Monday and which month, and what happens if, you know, the moon is at the point of eternal equinox? You know, you don't have to go off the wall in trying to interpret it, no. If the statute says dog, we're talking about a dog. We don't have to worry about which breed. A dog is a dog is a dog. Now, what happens if, though, the law is very ambiguous? What happens if it is so broad that it's next to impossible to figure out what the heck are they talking about? Well, here's the funny thing. In every single law that's passed, there is a reference. There's an index, there's definitions. So if the intent of the statute was to take a word and interpret it in a specific way, they define it. I'll give you something real simple, is not to be overly convoluted. A law is passed that the state once a year should recognize someone who is cool. Well, cool how? And cool in which way? What, they're thin-blooded? And because the air conditioning is blowing and it's like kind of cold in here and they're kind of chilly? Does it mean we're only supposed to give this award to someone who's chilly? Because that's what cool means. Or is it someone that does something that most people are like, wow? Or is it someone who's popular? You know, the word cool has different definitions, different meanings. Well, what the legislature do is they'll specifically define. Cool means this in this instant. So I'll give you an example. It doesn't exist in Sutton anymore because the bylaws have been changed. But when I started on the Board of Selectmen, our town charter only specifically mentioned men. So select man, elder man, only use the word man. But contained in it was a specific definition of the word man. man should not be interpreted to be gender specific. It applies to both men and women equally. Kind of like Thomas Jefferson. All men are created equal, you know, and entitled to certain unalienable rights. Jefferson didn't specifically mean, oh, it was only the dudes. No, man was referred to humankind, mankind, everybody. But if you tried applying the plain meaning rule to that specific reference when it said man, that might be confusing. So that's why the definition was applied. Same thing in the laws. Makes sense? Another thing courts look at is what is the history of this law? Because, by the way, there are records that are published. Because while the legislative body is drafting a bill, they have debates. They have hearings. There are evidentiary presentations by specialists. Well, all of that's contained and can be referred to. So if the court's trying to figure out, okay, we're trying to figure out how to apply this law in this circumstance, why did they make the law to begin with? Think about specific environmental regulations. You know how technical they are? That's important. Hey, I got 2 minutes left. I'm watching. Third. Public policy. So, here's how it works. Courts will get a statute, a law, like the Good Samaritan law. They'll attempt to apply it literally. If they can't, then they'll dig through the legislative history to try to figure out why the law was made to begin with. And if they still can't figure it out, they'll base a determination based upon what's good for the public. Think about what happened to the Circle Inn. The statute was passed that I mentioned, that wasn't in the facts, where California made it free to call 911. It's no longer a charge. Should, because you're not being charged, should a bartender tell someone who just says, can I use your phone to call 911, should they deny it? Well, the court basically based its decision on public policy. It costs nothing! But we could possibly save a life. So you gotta be mindful of this. So that's one of the reasons why when we review some of your homework assignments, you may think the court's going a certain way, and then when I tell you what the actual outcome is, oh, it's probably because it hinged on one of these things. Homework number two. Is due Wednesday.
Next one, did they write?
No.